Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, emanating from the Sea Carcass Lounge of the fabulous Fandango Hotel, the Blue Notes.
Keep your-
Springfield.
Thank you. good to me. In your eyes is like a light, showing me the way through the night. Oh yeah, without your love, I would surely die.
I think we're headed for That's how I feel. And I don't want the silent treatment. And I don't need to feel a chill.
Thank you.
it the truth? Ain't it the truth now, baby? Ain't it the truth now? What I said? truth now, baby? Ain't it the truth now? What I say? Ain't it the truth?
Gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Steve Lawrence.
It also gives me great pleasure to introduce the Blue Notes to you. On my ride all the way from Barcelona, Reverend Pancho San Pedro on keyboards. Performance at 120B, 140B, Hammond B3 organ. Rick, the bass player on bass. All the way from Memphis on drums, Mr. Chad Cromwell. To my left on trumpet, Mr. Tommy Bray. Hey. Also on trumpet from Kenosha, Wisconsin, the great Fumo. Chief of security back here, Woody. Nice to see you, Woody. On guitar and vocals, the Shaky Neil. Thank you, Steve. I feel sunny inside.
With you, baby. Feel sunny inside.
I hold you once more. Making love to you while time stands still. I may be dreaming, but I always will. Cause I'll be holding you when the twilight
Hey.
is one for the folks outside.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the big room. Calvi presents the Blue Notes.
Everything's alright. me to the corner that you call a home. I turned around and we were all alone. Come on in, she said with a smile. Come on in and we can rest a while. Because honey, thank you.
Thank you.
ground. He's ordering another round. By his own idea, Lord, he doesn't know where she is fighting man. Went and lost the biggest prize he ever had. A prize fighter can't be sad. When he smiles,
We had a request from the last set to do the song again for you. Your love is good to me. I got a right.
this crazy world, live my life like anyone else. How long can I carry this monkey around? All by myself. If I can't help you, I know nothing else. If I can't help you, thank you.
Through almost anything if you have a beautiful woman by your side.
nation ever since the world began. Never since the world began.
Thank you. Blue Notes. Thanks for coming out of the world, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Feeling all right? Feeling pretty good.
Played an acoustic show to start with, and then I did a little set of kind of club material, of some kind of blues material that I had, and that I'd written over, you know, the past, the songs that I had. And then we did a Crazy Horse set after that. So then I would enjoy doing that part of the show. There's only three or four songs in it. Come out, play acoustic. And the screen would open and the band would be there. And one of the roadies was playing sax. And Poncho from Crazy Horse was playing an organ. And we set it up. It was like a little lounge kind of thing, you know, with some blues kind of songs. And I found myself enjoying that part of the show really a lot. Then we'd take a little intermission, and then we'd come back and Crazy Horse would do it, you know, Crazy Horse set. Which by that time, after having done that for a couple of years, I was starting to get, you know, it wasn't much of a challenge. It wasn't like anything different or anything new. It wasn't turning me on too much. It was starting to wind down. So when I listened back to the tapes, because we recorded everything, when I listened back to the tapes when I got home, I found myself only listening to the three or four songs that I did like that. And that was all it made for me. That was all I liked. So it just started because I started doing it on a whim. Then I liked it. When I listened to it, I said, that sounds like I'm doing something. This sounds good to me, you know. And I was enjoying it, and it sounds good. So then we enhanced the group by adding five more horns. And then we changed bass and drums. We got a new bass and drums, and that's the way the Blue Notes is.
And did some of that material... Is that some of the material you're playing now, and is some of that on the album?
There's none of those songs on this album.
Right.
They may be on the next Blue Note album.
Right, because there seems to be a wealth of material that you're playing now that isn't on the album.
Yeah, well, we almost got two sets. We play two-hour sets, and I think we'll repeat four songs in the second set. And tonight we're going to try to eliminate those and replace them with more new ones. Yeah, I have three more new ones that I'm going to put in tonight. Hopefully, if we can get together for half an hour today to do it.
To rehearse. Those songs were written over what period?
These ones, the ones I'm going to do tonight, were written in the last 6 months.
If you look back for the last 5 years, is this the way you like to work? Have you changed genres? I mean, you made a rockabilly album, and you made a more country-inspired album, and all this. Is that, do you think that way consciously, or is it just something that...
Well, I try... I don't really have a conscious aim to do something different every time I do something. Like, this just started because I enjoyed doing this little set, you know. And as a matter of fact, if I had consciously was thinking of anything, it would be not to try to do something like that, because people were getting so angry at me for doing that, and so disillusioned with whether they could believe what I was doing. But I figured at least I wasn't selling beer, so it was, you know, that was okay. Maybe I should, you know. So there I am. I just did this because I liked it. I don't know what to say about the past and all the different styles that I've done and everything, other than maybe I'm just a frustrated actor or something, and I like to do different parts, you know. And I can get into the music of the different characters, and maybe that's a way of explaining it. But I know that it frustrates a lot of people that I do that. But then I used to listen to, you remember Bobby Darin? Well, he had a song, he started with Splish Splash, and then he had Queen of the Hop, then 4 years later he did Mack the Knife. Now, you know, and they were all great. There's nothing wrong with that. They were all fantastic. Every one of them was a different thing. The first two were more or less the same, but Mack the Knife was so different. And so there's nothing, you know, like I look at people like that and I say, well, it's possible to shift styles and directions and have it be valid. I'd rather try to do what I want to do than not do it because people say, well, you can't do that.
Is it more fun to lose on stage than to fall?
I love what I'm doing now. I think I've had fun doing everything that I've done, except some of the things that I did that were more down. And Tonight's the Night, I don't know if I was having fun or not, but I was into it, you know. But Tonight's the Night is not that far from the Blue Notes, really. It's just a darker side. And then even the Shocking Pinks some of the songs we did in our stage show, we had three horns that played in our show at the end, and we were doing the Slim Harpo songs and a couple of other blues type of things, Rain in My Heart, things like that. It's not that far away from what I'm doing now.
Are you surprised that the press seems to be indicating this is the best record that you've done in the 80s?
Well, you know, it's nice that they're doing that. Like, I'm always surprised. You know, I don't know what... I don't really know what to expect from the press because, I've had pretty well the full spectrum of reactions, and I think it's nice, you know. But I try not to take it seriously because, you know, I didn't take it seriously when they were putting me down, so I don't know what, you know, it wouldn't be fair to believe them now. I just have to believe myself. I mean, I think it's everyone's opinions are valid, but I can't be affected by them because they're only opinions. They're outside.
The 60s were the year of idealism, and the 80s are the years of realism.
Yeah.
Did that influence your songwriting? Did that change in some way?
I maybe it did. My song and my writing is only me, you know. It's just how I am. I think I'm more realistic now than I was in the 60s. But I still have ideals. I still have my my beliefs and what I think would be good for the world. So I still have the same soul that I had in the 60s, but I have a lot of edges of me kind of broken off and chipped and everything. So I feel more worn out now.
So what do you still believe? I mean, I found some interesting facts in these lyrics that it's like yin and yang, so Chinese say,
yeah,
positive,
yeah,
and negative. You wrote a lot of positive love songs, but at the same time you wrote some, negative love songs. And some people say, actually it's Jonathan Richman said, you have to suffer when you want to sing the blues.
Yeah. Well, I write about both sides for sure. I just write about what comes to me. Some years are better than other years. I feel really good right now. I feel really good about my family, and I feel good about the music I'm playing, and it enables me to take some subjects that are that I couldn't talk about before and illuminate on those.
What
else
subjects?
Well, it's a lot of the music about the Blue Notes music is all mostly about women. It's all about relationships, most of it, or parties, or street. You know what's happening on the street. Everything that's on my mind, you know, is in there.
The entire track is more like, I mean, that is about some kind of idealism.
This note's for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of idealistic. Yeah. Because really, when you get right down to it, I have to go and play the Budweiser concert series because they make a deal with the promoter. I can't get around it. But I want the people to know that it's not me making a deal with Budweiser and Miller. They bought all the places where I play. They bought them. You know, I didn't make a deal with them. They made a deal with the promoter. And now they give the promoter the money so the promoter can pay us. But we deal with the promoter. We don't deal with Budweiser or Miller or those companies because, you know, even though I drink Budweiser, I don't have to, you know. And I'm not telling everybody to drink Budweiser or Michelob. Saying this note, you know, playing that note because I like Michelob so much.
Do you think sponsorship and rock music is good for the music scene?
I think it's terrible. I think they should stick with the Olympics.
But it's growing.
It's growing. It's over. It's the 80s. Success to a child in the 80s is being a beer commercial spokesman. You know? Well, you know. You said that. I didn't say that. I'm only saying what I don't like, okay? What other people need to do and what they want to do is up to them. That's the beautiful thing, is everyone has their own set of things they believe in, and as long as they're true to those, then they're okay. Now for me, I'm not doing that. That doesn't mean that somebody else can't do it and be fine. I'm not trying to put anybody else down. I'm just saying, I have a relationship with my audience, and I don't want anything to come between me and them. And I don't like them to think that someone can come along and buy the music that I'm giving to them and put their stamp on it before it gets to them. And that's why I sing that song, because I don't like that.
How long ago did you write it?
6 months ago, something like that. 7 months ago.
That's a little longer than that.
After I finished my string of Levi commercials.
This works for you.
No, I wrote it.
I
did it at the last farm aid, didn't I?
Yeah. Were there any special things that happened to you that you wrote about? Any special stories about it?
Well, I kept seeing myself with the first time I really saw, you know, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, you know, Miller High Life concert series, you know, with that as big as us on the marquee. You know, I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? I don't know anything about Miller High Life concert series, or it just appears to be something it isn't. It appears to be what it isn't, and I don't like that. It's not like there's a difference in these shows and in people doing commercials, but they're so aggressive. They sit in a room and they see this market, and the conglomerate people, they see this market of all of us, create this music, and people buy the music, and they say, God, look at that, they sold millions of records. We could sell millions of beer, you know, sell millions of automobiles. So they, you know how it works. I can't explain that to you.
So how do you see the world now? I mean, in terms of this connection to the capitalism, so to say, but you mentioned one fact about the homeless in the Life of the City song. That, you know, there is a difference between rich and poor.
Huge difference. Very big difference there. And I don't know how. I think maybe the beer companies, you know, maybe the beer companies should spend, you know, instead of spending so much money on advertising, maybe they should advertise how they're helping the homeless, you know, or something like that. And I should too. Everybody should. Maybe part of the tickets should go to a food share program or something, you know, where it's just like a tax. You know, if we're committed to this, then maybe something like that should happen. But then that's like a different form of government. No, that's not a democracy. That's a whole other thing, you know. When you know, so you're walking on shaky grounds. We are at this, we get this capitalist democratic society, and if we try doing all these things to help the homeless, then all of a sudden it's not a free country anymore, because you're being told where your money has to go and everything even more. So people have to do it themselves. They have to have a conscience and try to help out where they can. People like me should do more concerts for the homeless, and beer companies should spend less money advertising and put more money into advertising that they built, like, you know, in Manhattan. They should have the Budweiser Center for the homeless or something, where they can go when it gets over or below 40 degrees at night. People can go there and sleep. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. That's one of the great titles in the world.
Right. You know, free beer for everybody when they go in there.
Can you say something about your separation with Geffen?
Goodbye.
Thank you. I think that really said it all.
You said in an interview 2 years ago that the next record company was signed to after Geffen would have to take a good look at your track record. You were going to take a good look at theirs. It kind of seems fitting in the way that going back to Reprise Records,
oh, yeah,
they're a company who know you and you know them. It's like,
oh, it's great. I'm back where I belong. That's the way it should always be. I made a big mistake leaving the priest.
Just going back to the idealism thing, it seems to me that through all the changes in the music, a lot of the ideals, you know, a lot of the things that you're expressing in these songs are the same that you expressed, or very similar in a different way, but to what you were saying when you were much, much younger. Is that, and there aren't many people like your peers who managed to retain that idealism. Do you think that's fair?
There aren't many people, my peers, that are still here now. There aren't that many of them left.
Right.
When you look back to where I started from, and you look around at all the people that were on the same stage as me back then, most of them are gone now. And the ones that are still here, some of them are hanging in there.
Right.
There's not that many of them, though. You know, and some, you know, a lot of them are still hanging in there and making great music. I mean, I think Eric Clapton has made some fantastic music in the last 10 years. You know, he continues to grow and continues to do good things. And Stevie Winwood, who was around when I started, basically just a couple of years after I started, he came along. At least I noticed him. And you know, he's still making meaningful music.
Yeah, I was interested in a quote Joni Mitchell said that the 70s were the time in which most of us discovered that we couldn't change the world, thought that perhaps we could change ourselves. And when we realised that we couldn't, we said, well, let's make money, and sort of we're doing something. I think it was partly facetious, but she was still talking about how they were saying sort of a lot of their ideals and slipped away, and their attitude to music.
I think the idealism on the audience slipped away. You know, it's just what the audience. The audience decides everything. They're in control. It's not the artist. The artist is only just singing the songs. The way they're interpreted is what's really happening. It's what, where people are at is what makes the artist successful or not successful. It's a coincidence of what the artist is saying and where the people are coming from. In the 60s, everybody thought we could change the world. And then in the 80s now, everybody's, you know, professionals. Either that or they're down and out. You know, or they're recovering drug addicts or alcoholics. It's a whole other thing now. There's a whole other kind of reality. There are so many recovering alcoholics in this country that used to be hippies. And recovering drug addicts that used to be hippies. It's a testimony. And then you have the professionals, you know, lawyers and all these people. None of these things are what people thought was going to happen. They didn't think about what was going to happen. They just had this, you know, peace and love and everything's going to be okay and we have to put down our weapons and forget everything and make the world into some sort of state of nirvana and everybody's going to be cool for the rest of time, you know. It didn't work. But the idea is still good. You have to have that idea. If you forget about the idea of everything being peaceful, then you're really lost.
And fundamentally, you're still optimistic about it.
About world peace?
Yeah.
I think world peace will really come about when a threat to the entire world comes about from another place other than the world itself. And that's really all the only thing that's going to bring us together.
Like the ozone layer going on.
No, not a scientific thing like that. I think it's going to have to be something, you know, farther out than that, you know. I mean, I can't see it. It seems like the only thing that brings a country together is when another country invades it. That brings everybody together. So, you know, I'm not saying people from some other planet are going to surround us and hit us with ray guns and everything, and we're going to all come together.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Not this week, anyway. Maybe next week.
You were also saying that in this, it seems that there's a bit more personal material and that reflects your state of family life and all that sort of stuff now. Can you talk a bit about that a bit?
You mean songs in this album here? The way that reflects on my family?
No, well, earlier in the interview, I think you just said how everything's pretty good now.
Yeah, things are good.
I don't know enough about where you live and how much time you spend there and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's just, you know, my family and everything is very solid. I feel really good about that. And I feel solid in my physical being and in my soul now, compared to the way I was maybe 5 years ago or something, you know. I spend a lot of time working on getting myself physically together. So I think a strength in the body is reflected in all ways, you know.
What about the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young reunion?
Well, we're making a record. We're making one. I'm not going to tour with them yet. But we're making a record. I don't want to tour with them.
Why?
They're not ready to tour. CSNY has got to be... It's got to be a strong... it's going to be a nostalgia show. When CSNY goes out, it's nostalgic. There's no way around that. Even if we do all new songs, it's nostalgia. So, when the people come to see us and there's all these 40-year-olds and stuff that come out with huge paunches and sitting around and been watching TV for 12 years and everything, and maybe mowing the lawn, maybe not. Well, you know, those people, when they come to see us, if they see a bunch of, like, wastoids up there that can't hold it up for 2.5 hours and really deliver like it's a championship fight or something, like they can't really get on it, and they're forgetting and just coasting through songs and obviously drugged out or obviously overweight and just not caring about themselves, then what are those people going to think about themselves when they come to see the group that they identify with in their lives? Is that, I don't want to show people that. I don't want people to see that. So I think there's a couple of problems that need to be handled within CSNY, and when those problems are handled, then CSNY will be ready to be presented to the world. And until then, I don't see there's any value in it at all.
Have you written any songs for them?
Yeah, I've got 3 songs on this new record.
When is the record coming out?
I don't know.
This year?
Maybe.
You think
it's more than half finished.
What are your thoughts about the record?
It's going to be a great record. It's easy to make a great record with CSNY because you can capture the great moments. but you can't hide the bad moments on stage. You see? So you can create an illusion of greatness, picking the moments that are there and putting them together into the... That's the way we always made records. And this record should be the best record we've ever made, I hope. And I think it should be very vital and very good, a really good record. There's no way, I don't know what people are going to say about it. People could say it's the worst piece of shit they ever heard in their life. I don't know. I have no way to tell that. I mean, you know. Well, you know.
When was the last time you were in the studio?
3 weeks ago. And it's very different from the Blue Notes. Now, Blue Notes is a very vital, alive. So these guys, this is the most fantastic thing that ever happened. Every second they're on stage, they're totally into it. Everybody is 100% awake and on the case. To them, they're living their lives. As each moment goes by, they're cherishing each moment of whatever success we get. No matter how small it is, it's like a diamond. It's a beautiful thing to see. Some of the guys in the band were working in warehouses loading cases 6 months ago. And this is, you know, this is a great thing. And they have families and everyone's doing well, and all of a sudden, you know, there's clothes for the kids and there's different things happening. Bills are getting paid. It's not like we're making a whole bunch of money, because all we're doing is playing these ballrooms. But it's a good feeling.
I heard you're going to tour this summer in the States. Is there any chance you're going to come to Europe? Maybe in the year or next year?
I'm not even sure about the United States tour. We're just waiting to see what happens with the Blue Notes. Right now, we're just all we're doing is the ballrooms. That's just really what the Blue Notes is. That's what we want to stand for. I think we'll always be playing ballrooms, no matter what else we do. We'll always go back to ballrooms because it's real. It's like all a big. I don't know how many of you were there over yet last night, but that's the right thing. It's the right size. You know, if we do bigger shows, we'll try to simulate that, but it'll be a simulation.
As far as something. Blues Notes material that hasn't been recorded, is the possibility of another album with the Blue Notes?
This note's for you too.
Can you not use that title? Of course it's going to be right. Because it's just a title.
What about the live album? It seems like something that you're translating.
That's probably what will happen down the road. A live record. Because this record here was recorded live in a rehearsal hall. There's no overdubbing or anything on the whole record. I don't like overdubbing. It doesn't apply to this kind of music. And there is a certain amount of blues out there now that blues has become kind of fashionable among the yuppies and different things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of restaurant blues. And it's true, and some of it's good, and some of it's overdubbed in studios, you know. And that's not what we want to do. We like to play it. And you can't get the power swing sound by overdub. You can't overdub power swing. It's like everybody doing it together.
Had you done any shows with the full band before you recorded the album?
Yeah, we did. We did some shows in the San Francisco area. We did 10 nights, 2 sets a night. Sort of like what we're doing here. I think we did 1, 2, 3, 4, 8, 10. 10 shows in this 2-week period as well. Same
pretty much went into the studio and tried to capture that.
Well, we recorded the entire, we recorded all the shows, just like we're recording these shows. We recorded everything, and we ended up using... we ended up using nothing from the first recording sessions, although there was a lot of great stuff. But we didn't use any of it because the bass and drums weren't right. Then we got a new bass and drum. And then we did this stuff. Since I had new bass and drums, it was like we'd already we'd already done the songs, and I like to get it the first time. I like to get the feeling the first time. So we brought in a new bass player and drummer, but when we played the old songs, it didn't sound the same. And even though it wasn't right with the old bass player and drummer, with the new bass player and drummer too, it was better. But it was better to have new songs. So I wrote 10 new songs, 9 new songs, something like that. And we did those.
Who's your favorite blues guitar? I mean, is the song that inspired you?
Well, I like, for guitar playing, I like Jimmy Reed and his guitar player. And I like Bobby Blue Bland and his band. They're great. And I listen to those, to that music a lot. Alan Wolf. I see what I just like. Little Walter. Mark Blair. Johnny Hooker. And Steve Cotton Blues Band. Paul Butterfield, Mike Bloomfield. There's a lot of them. But I think my favorite is Jimmy Reed. Bobby Blue Bland.
How do you like the reaction from the audience this time? Because I haven't been to the venue yet, but I will tonight. But I've heard that they're mostly beer drinking white kids, just to, you know, be out there having, trying to have a good time. And I've heard that a lot of kids are out there yelling at you, saying, "Well played, Thousand Man, Ohio." Or
something. Oh, really? I haven't heard one person yell at. I never heard that at all. Maybe you should go down there and check that out yourself. All I hear is people yelling how they love it. Yeah. That's all
there's
I heard.
There was one guy last night saying LA a couple of times, but he was one guy and 2,000 people.
Yeah, right. And, you know, everybody, you know, I don't hear that at all. So, before I form that opinion, I'll check that out myself.
It was pretty interesting since the album is only out a little over a week, but there were a lot of people singing along with the song. Especially
yeah.
10 Men Working.
Mm-hmm. 10 Men Working, Life in the City.
Right.
Yeah. Even
the
last
few where they sing the
chorus. There's four or five songs that they're singing all the words on. Yeah. No, I think that they're eating it up. I've seen audiences before and seen them reacting to the new material. You have to take into consideration, we're playing over 2 hours, and we're repeating 4 songs twice. So, you know, maybe 5. And we're trying to get it to be 2 sets with no repeats, except maybe the last song in each set. And Dissonance for You, we'll do that twice. We're trying to get it to that point. You know, I don't have quite enough up-tempo songs to do that.
Wow. I thought it was creeping, but now they're all alive, my God.
Do you have the feeling the fans are with you, have moved with you throughout the year, so do you pick up new fans and you change the new stuff by like Robert Gary and Lewis and different style?
Well, see, one thing is rockabilly. I know it's just a name, but our music, the Shocking Pink's record was old rock and roll, pop rock and roll. It wasn't rockabilly. Rockabilly is a different thing. That's like what the Stray Cats were playing. We weren't doing that. It was more of a blues bass kind of thing that we were doing. More of a rhythm and blues kind of white rhythm and blues pop thing. Was very popular back in the 50s. And where that originally came from is when I did Old Ways. I did Old Ways and I took it into Geffen. The first Old Ways I did, and I gave it to them, and I thought it was great. I recorded it in Nashville and I really liked it. And I asked them what they thought, and they said that it scared them. That they didn't like it. And then that really ticked me off, because I thought it was really good. And that was the first Old Ways record, which has nothing to do with the second Old Ways record. I made another Old Ways record after that. But anyway, when they said that, and they said, why don't you make a rock and roll album? So I made a rock and roll album that I made, you know, just like 20 years ago, but it was still rock and roll. So that's where everybody's rocking came from. It's kind of like, that's how it triggered in my head anyway. And I don't know how I got onto that, but I don't know what the original question was.
If you feel that the fans have moved with you throughout the years, do you pick up new fans?
I think we picked up new ones. Because, you know, a lot of the ones that are out there now weren't even born when I started. And especially among the listening audience, not so much the live concert audience. These little shows we're doing, there's no way that the middle-aged fans that I have are going to make it to these shows because they can't handle the intensity of the tickets. You know, we have to get to a point where all of the intense fans are satisfied and there's still tickets left for the more laid-back people who just want to go to a show and maybe not have to buy the ticket the first day it comes out. So that would be a bigger venues and stuff like that. So I think that there's a lot of new fans, especially with this music. There's a lot of older fans and younger fans that I can feel, I can sense that there's a lot more.
I think your guitar playing is bringing back a lot of fans on this record. It's blazing stuff somehow.
It's a 2-minute commercial.
It's blazing slice of vinyl.
I'm not sure I phrased that for you, but.
Yeah, right. A blazing slice of vinyl.
I like that.
Is that a conscious effort on your part?
Watch you don't burn your leg over there.
Blazing slice of vinyl. Hold it sideways so it can cut right through.
Is that a conscious effort on your part to do more guitar playing on this record?
Just sounds like this kind of music gives me a vehicle to play more guitar. The country stuff, when I was playing country music, it was a rhythm guitar thing that I would get into. Because the color of that music is not, you know, the fiddle and the steel guitar and a little of this and that. It's not so much in the blues. I always at home would play blues on my guitar ever since, you know, I would do a set with Crazy Horse, and then I go back on my bus and sit down and start playing blues and look out the window. You know, the only difference is now that I'm playing what I play at home in front of people all the time.
You end up playing old songs on the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe in the cinema and stuff like that.
By adding the horn section, I thought that your vocal got more emotional.
Well, I think the whole thing at once made everything more emotional. It's right. There's something right about this. I don't know why. There's just something right about it. I mean, I guess if you do enough things, eventually you're going to hit on something right, you know. Where you just fall in your pocket, you know. And you search around, you know. Most people find the right thing and that's it. They stay with it for all time. You know, I could still be doing Harvest. You know, and put out one like that every 4 or 5 years, except nobody'd be buying it, and I'd be working, you know, I'd be somewhere else. I don't know. But I didn't do that. So in the process of changing around and everything, I did some things that although I was really enjoying them at the time, they alienated a lot of people, and, you know.
This seems very natural question for you.
This one here?
Yeah.
Feels like it.
Very comfortable.
But, you know, on another level, the ironic thing about this is that I know that if I'd have tried to do this record a couple of years ago, I would have gotten sued for it. You know, what do you mean you're going to have a horn section and play blues? You know? That's uncharacteristic of Neil Young. That's what I got sued for. So, you know, in as much as I should be able to just put that in the past, it keeps coming up every once in a while. I don't see where this is any more off the wall than a country record, or any less off the wall, or whatever, you know. That's what really surprises me about the whole thing, is that all of this gets accepted. I'm not fighting with it, but was just a surprise.
Looking back over the other records, which are the ones that give you most satisfaction now when you hear them again or play them again with your albums?
Well, of the Geffen years, I would say Everybody's Rocking is the best one. And before that, I think Tonight's the Night is the best one. Maybe this one. Now, if you take those three records and put them together, they look like them. They look like they were born to be together. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, they look like a matched set of three. Just like Comes a Time, Harvest, and Old Ways. There's three there too. And then there's Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, Rust Never Sleeps, and Zuma. You know, they're all together too. So there is a pattern there somewhere. Something, you know, there is some method in there somewhere. There's a repeating thing. So.
Could I ask you about a book I picked up 2 weeks ago, and one which was written by your father?
Oh, yeah.
Have you read it?
Yeah, I did. I read it, yeah.
Just tell me, how do you feel about that?
Well, it was fascinating for me to see how my parents, what they thought of me when I was growing up, you know. To see my parents' reactions to when I got polio and things like that. To see it written, how, having my own children, knowing how vital it is when something happens to your child. Seeing that once I was a child and they were feeling that way about me like I feel about my children. I think that to me was the most fascinating part of it. Yeah, that's the part that struck me the most.
I've been working with film before. Is that something that's going to happen again?
Yeah, I think more and more. I like making film.
What about the video?
Which video?
For this new album, are you going to make some video?
Well, we have some plans in the works right now for a video long form. We're working on it. Tim Hutton and I are working on it.
What kind of concept is that?
It's a story.
Yeah. I apologize.
It's a success story.
Do you have any thoughts on the presidential election? Just to change the subject.
That's a good jump. Is today primary day in New York?
Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking last night, I was trying to go to sleep, I was thinking, God, I wonder if Jesse Jackson's asleep now, or if he's asleep. No, I was thinking, is he, you know, are they saying, good night, Jesse, see you in the morning? Or is he up, like, watching TV, you know, secretly smoking cigarettes, you know, doing unpolitical-like things in the middle of the night, you know?
Are you going to write a song about that? No.
I don't know. I don't know who's gonna win. I hate to see George Bush. That wouldn't be too good.
No, the Reagan got us the war finally. No, they got the enemy on side.
Oh yeah, but didn't they have some more? Yeah, they did it again, didn't they? Well, I like Jackson's remarks on that. He said, "Well, they're shooting us now with our own weapons. We're selling them weapons, and they're shooting at us with our own weapons."
It was
really
Gaddafi endorsed Bush, so
there
must be hope,
yeah. Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Set back Bush's
I don't know what to think. I don't know whether we should be over there or not in the Persian Gulf. Arden thinks we should. Of course we should be there to try to keep the things flowing. On the other side, it's such a bad place to be. I mean, you know, we can only get in worse trouble by being there. It's one of those things where it's like you have a scab and you don't know whether you should pick it or not, you know. It's a terrible thing. You don't know what to do. You think, well, if it's a boil or something, it's as bad as that. You know, it's like it's a deterioration of your own body. And you think, well, I could save it if I just put a hole in it, you know. It's terrible. But what are you going to do? It's that bad of a thing. It really is. I mean, it's a whole country, and it's a whole civilization and a way of life that has to make a decision like that. I don't know what it would be like to have to make decisions like that, and then stand up the next morning and say, yes, we blew the shit out of that, and we killed 40 people, and, you know, I don't know what it would be like to be like in that position of power.
It's your own action.
Well, Reagan doesn't have to worry, you know, he can do whatever he wants, which they should bear in mind over there, you know, because he really will do whatever he wants.
But on the domestic side, and you were talking about homelessness and stuff earlier, do you see any hopeful signs that...
Jesse Jackson would really change that, and he would screw up a whole bunch of other things in doing it, because, you know, the actual methods for doing it. There's got to be more than one or two reasons why it hasn't happened yet. I don't know what they are, but, you know, just economically, the feasibility of saving all the homeless and reinforcing all of this. The welfare system doesn't work. I mean, you know, we tried a lot of different things with this, and it didn't work. You know, it's not a problem that you can just solve because it's bigger than it used to be.
Would you support him on the basis of at least give it a shake, or...
Who, Jackson?
Yeah.
Well, I'm domestically, I think I would support Jackson. Because so I think it would be really something just to see what would happen. I mean, I don't know, except for the fact that you know, he's probably the most vulnerable of any candidate. And if anything happened to him, that would be the worst thing for this country that could ever happen. Because it would really split the country right down the middle. So that, you know, there's a lot of pluses and minuses. Dukakis would probably just be business as usual.